Okay, as you can see before you, take one guess what tonight's lecture will be about. Hey, listen. Can't pull the wool over Steve's eyes. Okay. This is the syllabus for tonight, folks. I did not have time to type this up, but when I give you your completed syllabus at the end of the course, we're just doing it a little bit differently. But I will give everyone a updated syllabus that will actually be, you know, you'll be able to hang on to and use as an outline if you ever want to review your notes and what we actually covered and stuff. Tonight, we have a hefty order in front of us. I'm going to try in the first hour to talk about the pre-Socratics and wrap it up. Forget it, it's never going to happen. We'll be lucky if we get to... I'm not going to spend much time on Heraclitus and Parmenides because Heraclitus, whenever, even if I teach a philosophy class in high school, I always try to... I always debate whether or not I should teach him because he's so elusive and he's so difficult to understand. Even if you have all of his sources in front of you, all of the actual fragments that he wrote, and there's a very good book. I was going to bring in all of my books and I forgot them at home. I'll bring them in next time to show you the different sources that we use for this these things. But you try as much as you can to go back to the original source material. When you get to guys like Thales and Anaximander, Anaximenes, Heraclitus, very difficult. All you have usually are fragments. There are no completed writings that these guys did. But from the fragments and from the writings of two guys, basically Xenophon and Herodotus. Why do you laugh when I say Herodotus? You don't like him, huh? But Herodotus tells us, he tells us some of the wild stories that these guys did, like the time Thales fell into a hole while he was looking at the stars. That probably never happened. He also tells us that Thales predicted a complete solar eclipse. That probably never happened either, because we know from studying astronomy when a solar eclipse would have happened, and there would have been no solar eclipse during his lifetime in that area. So... you know, we got to take with a grain of salt some of the things Herodotus tells us. And as far as Xenophon, he wrote a lot about Socrates. Plato did too. Socrates is a guy who never wrote anything. He didn't leave us any writings at all. But he's probably the most influential philosopher that ever lived. And it all has to do with this trial of his in 399 BC before these three guys who brought him up on charges. Well... this is what we've got ahead of us. Now, it would take me normally close to half a year just to get through the pre-Socratics in high school. So we are not, I mean, you know, with the seniors. As a matter of fact, we're through all of this year, and we're looking at existentialism right now. But the these guys take a long time. They really do, especially this guy down here. So we're going to have to nip and cut some things. And if you have any questions, stop me as we go along. I'm laughing because I just know the volumes of stuff we have here. These are just my notes on them that I usually give to the kids as handouts, and I mean, we wouldn't even have time to read these in 3 hours, never mind comment on them. So, what I'm going to do is, first of all, begin with a little word of prayer, and then I'm going to show you this map, and I want to show you a couple of very basic things about philosophy that happen, and... some very general things before we get into some of the more individual things and look at these personalities. All these guys, these are all guys. Thales and Anaximander and Anaximenes, Heraclitus, Parmenides and Pythagoras, they're all guys. And they're all Fruit Loops, almost all of them. They've all got some things about them that are really hilarious. Like Zeno, I don't even have Zeno on the board, I don't know if we could handle him. Zeno is the guy that said that two chariots that are coming towards each other can never pass intellectually. They can never pass each other. And nobody has yet been able to disprove him. Because he said going at a consistent speed, they cut the distance between them constantly. And if no matter how, if you have a positive number, oh boy, I shouldn't have even started this. But if you have a positive number, folks, for example, let's say you have two chariots here. These are the way I draw chariots. There's a little visor. You have two chariots, and they're heading towards each other. What happens is, if this one's going 50 miles an hour, and this one's going 50 miles an hour, there is a positive distance here between the two of them, correct? Okay? Now, they're consistently going to be splitting the distance between the two of them, correct? Now, if you have a positive number, like 10, and you split that number in half, you get 5. If you split that in half, you get 2.5. If you split that in half, you get 1.25, right? And you can keep on splitting, and then you can get to 1. And if you split that in half, you have 0.5. And then you split that in half, and you have 0.25, but you can never come to 0, as long as this is positive. So if these two chariots, he says, and you prove that I'm wrong, speaking of philosophy, Leo, you need to grab one of each of these handouts, okay? You might want to put your stuff down first. I don't know if you can, how.
Gotcha.
But do you get the idea of this? If this is a positive number in here, you can split it an infinite number of times and never come to 0. So theoretically, they can never, and this is one of his 4 paradoxes. He's got 4 of these now. This is Zeno. Yeah.
I thought that too, like in math in high school, you can sit there and you can draw a line on your piece of paper, and then you can divide that line an infinite number of places. So you can take your finger and push it across an actual infinity, an infinite space.
Right.
And this, to me, is amazing.
The space gets microscopic. Now here's the paradox, and this is why they're called a paradox. And Zeno was really aggravating because he would come and he would just aggravate people with things like this, and they would say, yeah, but two chariots do pass each other. If you watch them, if you watch the two chariots, they're coming at each other. And here's another one. And guess what? He says they do pass each other. So your theory's wrong. He says prove it. And they can't. And there's actually 4 of these, and they get more insane. The one about the arrow.
Is this like pi? Like 0.333333333?
That it goes on to infinity?
Yeah.
No. That's not what he's getting at. The Pythagoreans are going to get in trouble with something like that, though. Infinite numbers. Aristotle cannot even imagine such a thing as 0. That's the most ridiculous thing in the world to him. The Greeks are afraid of infinity. They always were. If something is infinite, it's wrong. The Greeks live in a very small, measured universe. Everything can be calculated, weighed in balance, measured. Distances can be calculated. All of that, it can all be mathematically weighed out. And if something is infinite with the Greeks, we have some problems. Because all of a sudden, the universe is no longer calculated and measured and all of this. And it's going to get the Pythagoreans in some trouble. We'll talk about them later. They're a wild bunch. They're half scientists and half religious cult. And one of the things in their religious cult is, thou shalt not. And you can understand why they would say this. They lived in like a commune thing. One of their rules was, Pythagoras said, thou shalt not eat beans. And, you know, I could imagine maybe the close setting and everything, him wanting to avoid that as one of his laws. I don't know. You know, maybe he had some bad experiences. But I could pick and choose things out of these guys, but we would never get to any kind of structured study of them. So, okay. Let's begin with just taking a look at the map, first of all, because if we can't plug in geographically, we usually have problems down the road. What did I say this area right here is called? Anybody remember?
Ionia.
Excellent. And this is important because philosophy begins in Ionia. All philosophy begins in Ionia, especially in one little city-state, one little polis called Miletus, M-I-L-E-T-U-S, Miletus. Miletus, a small city-state. These first 3 guys are all going to come from there. I mean, this must have been like Larry, Moe, and Curly, because when they get together, they all believe in a principle, but they all radically disagree about that principle. And I'll explain that to you in a moment. But here's the way I want you to think of philosophy. I remember somebody showed me this one time, and I thought it was excellent. Philosophy begins, think of this as a pendulum, okay? Philosophy begins in Ionia, see it? And then it takes a broad swing to Sicily. See it? And then it kind of stops in mainland Greece. See that? So it goes like this. It goes from Ionia to Sicily to Greece, because there's a guy named Pythagoras of Samos. Anybody ever hear of Samos before? What's Samos famous for? What is Samos famous for? Come on. Persian Wars.
The battle of Samos Bay.
The Battle of Samos Bay. Remember the Persian fleet? Xerxes on his throne? Remember me standing on the chair making a fool of myself? Xerxes on the throne looking down over Samos Bay, watching all of his ships get rammed and sunk. Remember? Okay, because all the Greeks that were in Athens, they took off and they went to Samos, the island of Samos. Well, Pythagoras is from Samos, and he's going to end up getting chased out of there, and he's going to go to a place called Crotonia, which is in Italy. Is it in Italy or Sicily? One of the two, over there somewhere. I think it's Sicily. But and then after Pythagoras has done his thing, we come to, you know, Socrates and his great pupil Plato, who's probably the greatest philosopher that ever lived. And that's why I say when getting to spending 1 hour in Plato is going to be like impossible. I don't know if we're going to be able to do it. Yes.
Do we have a handout on Thales?
No, none on Thales. I have one, but I didn't get a chance to copy it. Maybe during the break I can do it for you or something. I don't know though. Our copy machine is so slow. I think there's a little Italian guy in there going. That's to come out of nice. A little more darker, looking nice. Okay. I hope there's no Italian. Don't get mad at me. I love Italian people. A lot of Italian food, everything. Okay. All right. So basically, this is Ionia, and there's a place called Miletus, and that's where our story begins. Okay? No questions?
How do you like cement?
All right. Let's take a look at Thales. Now, basically, this is basically a copy of the handout that you're going to get that I will give you on this. Thales lives in Miletus in Ionia and flourishes around 585. You'll have all these notes. You don't have to take notes on all of these things. We're just going to go through them pretty quickly. I'm going to give you a copy of this handout, okay? If you want to write something down, that's fine. It's important to realize that all of these guys up until Plato write in poetry. When you read fragments from Heraclitus, and he's like impossible. Anybody that would ever be a lunatic enough to want to do a paper on Heraclitus, you know, he's unbelievable. It's very difficult to understand what he believes. I'll tell you a little bit about him after. But these guys all basically come from Ionia, from Miletus, these first three guys. And all of them, he comes from Ephesus. And all of these guys are writing poetry, or some form of poetry, some kind of epic verse style writing. Yes? No, I wouldn't call what they wrote real poetry, like you mean like iambic pentameter, like Shakespearean poetry? No, it's nothing like that. It's like Homer, for example. When Homer wrote, there was no good form of Greek writing. And so the writings of Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, were carried along by oral tradition. And they were passed on. It wasn't until about 100 years later that these stories, they were orators who would come and basically they had the entire Odyssey memorized. And they would go and they would perform for kings and people and impress them with these heroic stories of Odysseus and Agamemnon and these kings, you know, who's the guy with the heel there? Achilles. And all of these famous characters. And then they were put down into writing later, which is something that me and Steve were talking about yesterday afternoon, how the Bible is always being criticized because the manuscripts aren't that, you know, the manuscripts don't go back far enough or this or that, or how do you know it's the real Bible? When the, what was it that Josh McDowell pointed out? With the, he said that as far as the Bible, there are literally hundreds of thousands? What is it?
24,000.
There are 24,000 copies of the Bible, and most of them are all consistent with each other. Yet with Homer, the Homeric epics, they're much further removed from the time in which they were written than the Bible is. You see what I mean? And also, but if you go to college, they would never think of criticizing Homer or say, this isn't actually what Homer wrote. You know what I mean? Or this isn't actually what Homer said. They'd never even consider that, but oh, the Bible, oh. That's off. You see, they're inconsistent.
Satan doesn't care about Homer.
Okay, so They're writing in some kind of poetic verse, which is common to their day. As far as Thales is concerned, there are even no fragments. Everything that we know about Thales comes from what other people said about him. Aristotle is our primary source for Thales, and Aristotle's a tough guy. A lot of times, Aristotle likes to interpret things as he goes along, rather than just report the facts, which is what a good historian like Thucydides is known as the first scientific historian. Thucydides is going to look at the Peloponnesian War and record the facts and make no comment upon them. Not so with Herodotus. It's full of comments. It's like a storybook. Well, Aristotle's like that too. Aristotle doesn't make things up, but what Aristotle does if he doesn't like somebody, it's very obvious in his writing that he doesn't like the guy. You see what I mean? Because Aristotle is a philosopher in his own right, which we won't get into because he was more of a physicist. Than a philosopher lives later than Plato. He's a student of Plato. Socrates Aristotle's a student of Plato, and Plato's a student of Socrates. So the idea is, these guys are all living in Miletus, and they come up with this incredible thought, which is really, if you think about it, an unbelievable thought to come up with in this early day. They come up with this idea that if you boil everything down, if you take everything, this desk, if I take this desk and this cup and this tape and this stand right here, and I boil everything down to one substance, that there is one underlying substance of which all things are made. That's what he says. Now, that's what these three guys say. They all agree that there's basically one thing in the universe of which all things are made. Now, is that true? Yes, it is. Everything's made of atoms. Everything is made of atoms and a combination of atoms. So these guys are right on the mark with their theory. And you're talking about, look at when he's flourishing, almost 600 years before Jesus Christ. When they say that the Ionian philosophers had a lot on the ball, they're not kidding. For somebody to actually sit there, now remember, this thought has never, as far as we know, entered into the human mind before, as far as man is concerned, to sit down and say, I wonder what the basic stuff of the universe is. I wonder what the basic substance, the basic stuff, which underlies everything, including human beings, what is it? And Thales comes up with this, with his theory. He says it's all made out of hyder, Greek word hyder, from which we get, who knows? Hydrogen. Well, is hydrogen water-based? I know this much about chemistry. Is it? Okay. That's right. Okay. So water. Now listen. That's right. That's right. Water, oxygen. Water. Two pots water. One pot oxygen. Is that it? Oh, all right, okay. So now here's the idea. We get the word hydro, meaning water, okay? A hydroplane, that kind of thing. He says that if you boil everything down to its basic substance, all things are made out of water. Sound plot? Now listen, so you say, come on, that's ridiculous. And he goes, oh yeah? What kinds of things are there in the universe? And you would say, well, what kind of thing would a physicist say this is?
Solid.
A solid, right? What kind of thing would he say steam is?
A gas.
A gas. What kind of thing would he say coffee is?
A liquid,
right? Those are the three basic kinds of things, right? Groups of things. If you take water and if you freeze it, what do you have? You have a solid. If you leave it in its natural state as it sits on this earth, you have what? A liquid. And if you boil it, you have a gas. He says it's perfect. It fits perfect. That's what it is. All things. Now, isn't that pretty amazing? For 600 years BC, I wouldn't have thunk of that. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, did your mustache go away? You look 25 years younger.
Yeah.
Okay, so do you understand what he's saying? He's not just making a statement, he's also backing it up with some kind of facts. This is pretty incredible for 600 years before Christ. Now, the other thing that he says, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, he says that magnets have a psyche. But you have to understand the word psyche, or psuche in the Greek, doesn't mean what we know. The Greek word psyche, or psyche, means soul. He doesn't mean that. Psyche doesn't mean soul in 600 BC in the Attic Greek. This is Attic Greek that they're using, okay? It doesn't mean that. It means, here's what it does mean. It means self-moving. When he says that a magnet has a psyche, he means that it's self-moving, something that has an inner power. He looks at a magnet and he says there's an inner power involved in this thing. It's able to do something within itself that is not that most things are not able to do. It's got a power of its own. It's something that has within itself the power to be self-moving. It can move itself. You know the old experiment with the metal chips? You know, I mean, seventh grade experiment, right? The metal chips over a piece of paper and you put the magnet there and you see the magnetic fields, right? Something that can move itself without being pushed. Okay, let me get the next page up here. I think these guys are pretty fascinating when you consider the time in which they're running around. Repelling or attracting. Yep, or attracting, opposite poles attracting. Okay? It can also mean something that has within itself a source of motion or is simply alive. To Thales, the liquid underlying basic stuff of the world is alive. Sound like anything familiar? We're going to see it even more. No, go back to what we studied before. Lil, excellent. Excellent, Lil. What is it that separates the earth from the sky, or the earth from the vault of the heaven? Lil, remember, in the Sumerian cosmology. And what does Lil do? Begets everything. Therefore, everything is made out of Lil, right? Now, everything is made out of Lil. No, the May are what control the laws of the universe. They're the Sumerian laws. Okay. But we're going to see that more over here, all right? So hold on for just a second. You're going to see a lot of connections tonight. So stuff is alive, okay? There are gods in everything. Like the Sumerians before him, he believes that everything is alive. For the Babylonian astrologers, the stars were gods, okay? For Thales, they were steam from a pot. They were steam from a pot, water. You get the idea? All things are water. These three concepts alone qualify him as the first philosopher, and for that matter, a scientist. What makes Thales important is not the truth or falsity of his ideas, but it is the kinds of questions that he asks. Nobody asked those kinds of questions before. I wonder if I take this cassette and boil it down to one substance, what it would be. We know today, a microphysicist would tell you exactly what it's made out of. It's made out of atoms, and now we're seeing a whole new world with a lot of the advancements that have been made in microscopes. We're seeing a whole new world inside the atom. And when we get to Plato, you're going to see a lot of people are not very impressed with Plato today, but that's wrong, because I'll tell you who is very impressed with Plato. Physicists are very impressed with Plato, because he describes this thing called the receptacle that we're going to study, and he says the receptacle is this crazy world of flickering images. And you know what? Werner Heisenberg, who's one of the greatest microphysicists that ever lived, after a full day in his laboratory of looking at subspecies under electron microscopes, comes back and he's outside on the porch smoking a cigarette with his colleagues, and he says, "Well, gentlemen, you know what?" He says, "What do you think? Is Plato right? Is that crazy world that we see inside of an atom what Plato was talking about? Did he have it on the money?" And they were like, "Watch, we'll see. I'm going to show you what he means by that." Now watch how these things come together, okay? Don't miss the connections. So Thales' question, and that is, what is the basic stuff of the universe, assumes two important things. Number one, let me get this up so you can see it. Number one, all things have a basic substance or property. Okay? There's a property. There's a basic stuff of which the universe consists. Number two, there is a basic order. No chaos. You see it? Things are ordered in the world. We can come up with a way to realize how things are, how they work. The world is coherent enough to make it possible for such a question to be satisfactorily answered. To him, liquidity was the underlying substance of all physical reality, whether it be a gas, liquid, burning, or solid. Now, here's something you have to understand. Don't think of hydr, as difficult as this is going to be, don't think of hydr as water. It's not. It doesn't mean water like you think of a glass of water. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about the concept of liquidity. He's talking about, hyder means flowing. It means liquidity. It means a substance which is just liquidity. I mean, I don't know how else. It's a liquid substance. That's how he's seeing things. It's very real to him, okay? All right, good. We're moving along good here. If I lose anybody or you don't understand something, just make sure you interrupt me and ask, because we don't want to. That's the base substance. Exactly. As a matter of fact, we'll see that more in a minute. We're going to see something, what this guy believes, how he's going to contradict him. I'll show you that. But this base substance is going to be very important. These are some of the traditions that have followed Thales about his life. And like I said, none of it can be proven. Some of it is written by Heraclitus, and that speaks volumes about the stuff. But supposedly he was of Phoenician parentage. He derived much of his education from Egypt and the Near East. He was engaged in business and provided for himself the basic needs of life. Aristotle tells this great story. He says that he was able, because he was such a genius, to predict that there would be an incredible olive crop that year. There's going to be an incredible crop of olives this year. So what he does is, there are islands that rent olive presses. And an olive press in the ancient world was just basically a very, very simple machine that would save lots and lots of time crushing these olives and getting the oil out of them. Okay? What he does is, being the genius that he is, and we kind of got to believe Aristotle. It's very difficult to disbelieve anything Aristotle tells us, because he's such a super genius. I mean, he was a genius not on one level, but on several. He was into taxonomy, which is the study of classification of species. He was the guy was just brilliant. He really was. He studied the poetics. We talked about him with Theodore last week. Remember the theater, the poetics that I brought in? The politics, what makes a good state. His ethics, Aristotle's ethics, gets into metaphysics and things like that, which we'll talk about when we get to Plato. Now, so he says that what happens is, he knows it's going to be a really great crop of olives. So he goes out and he rents every single olive press that he can find. Okay? And he rents them, and he just keeps them in his garage or something. And then, of course, he was right, and there was an incredible olive crop, and he had all of the olive presses in the whole area. So now he's renting them out for like twice or three times the amount that he paid for them. You know, pointing up the fact that he's he was a shrewd businessman, you know. One time, he was supposedly, this is Heraclitus, folks. He was so absorbed with looking at the stars that he fell into a ditch while walking. Haha, probably not. He is unanimously credited with the introduction of mathematical and astronomical science into Greece. Probably not. Heraclitus. In Egypt, this is something that Aristotle says he did, and this is pretty amazing. Listen to this. Could you think of this? He wants to find out how big the pyramids are. Now, you can't run up to the top of the pyramid with a ruler, right? What he does is, he waits till till his shadow, the size of his shadow, is equal with his own height. Right? And then he measures the shadow of the pyramid. Isn't that good thinking? I'd have been there like, I don't know how we're going to measure this thing. But he waits until the shadow of a man is equal to the shadow of himself. You know, the shadow? His shadow is equal to his own height. And then he says, okay, quick, measure the pyramid. And that's how he measured them. Now, that comes from so good a source as Aristotle, so we kind of have to believe it. Returning to Ionia, he pursued the logical study of geometry as a deductive science and demonstrated several of the theorems later collected by Euclid. Absolutely true. Euclid is the great geometrist. Anybody know that name, Euclid? Euclidean geometry? Basic plane geometry, solid geometry. Okay. What's that?
All the proofs.
What about the proofs? I don't know. I don't know that.
The theories of geometry, one of them that we had in school, you had to prove every single angle.
You have to prove angles all the way through solid geometry, all the way into physics. Yeah. I mean,
there was one that was a particularly fan of that guy.
Yeah, I don't know. In his old age, he received by common consent the word sophos or sage. And when Greece came to name it seven wise men, it placed Thales at the top of his list. Now, that comes from Heraclitus, but Heraclitus never tells us who the other six were. Huh?
Well,
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, Herodotus. Herodotus never tells us who the other six were, so that's kind of a useless bit of information. And this is these are a couple things that I found in a book by Arthur Koestler, who wrote a book called The Sleepwalkers, which is absolutely magnificent. I'll bring it in so you can see it next time. But he said, when he's talking about Thales, he said, he has some... Right along, we're just about done with Thales here. So when he was asked, what is difficult, he said, it is difficult to know thyself. When he was asked, what is easy, he said, to give advice. And then asked, what is God, he answers, that which has neither beginning nor end, which is a very, very unusual concept to him, because many scholars believe that when he said that, he was actually saying there is no God. Because we know from the various sources that he had that he did not believe in anything that was infinite. You see what I'm saying? So for him to say that God is that which has no beginning or end, exactly, and there is no such thing, is the point. Asked how men might live most virtuously and justly, he answered, if we never do ourselves what we blame in others. Pretty good little bit of information. And then lastly, he is the first of what Aristotle calls the physikoi philosophers, or the physical philosophers. He's the first physicist. He's looking, what does a physicist do? Looks at something physical and says, huh, I wonder what this is all about. I wonder how this works. Isn't that what Sir Isaac Newton does? Sir Isaac Newton is sitting, supposedly, if we can believe his biographer, sitting underneath an apple tree, and the apple knocks him on the head. And Isaac Newton, the brilliance of the man, and he was an absolute genius on many levels. Again, he did, he wrote the book The Optics, in which he took a prism. I'm going to turn the lights on. In which he took a prism and he separated light into its infra and ultra different rays, into seven different rays, the seven different colors, which are the spectrum. He also, that's in his book The Optics. Then he wrote a book called The Principia Mathematica in 1689. And in that book, he takes the universe and he gives mathematical consistency to the universe for the first time. Then he comes up with his theories of motion. You know the thing? You ever see the steel balls there? And you take one and it goes duck, duck. For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction, his laws of physics. What is he doing, though? What is he doing in those experiments? He's looking at natural things. He's looking at a billiard ball, and he's saying, if I take this cue ball and hit it, and it hits the three ball, why is it going to move the five ball in that direction? Because for every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. You see what I mean? And so he's looking at the natural world, things that are happening, and he's choosing to solve very individual problems.
God was a mathematical.
God was a mathematical.
It was big time. It was almost like the scholars around the world were flipping out. Ooh, this could be possible.
Oh, really?
God boiled down to a mathematical.
I never heard that, but I'm going to tell you something. Wait till we get to Pythagoras. That's all I can say. This guy is out to lunch. But you'll see. No, I don't know that particular guy that you're talking about, but. You're going to see, when we get done studying today, you're going to see that there's absolutely no difference. You know what I mean? I mean, there's nothing in what he said that is new. There's nothing new under the sun, right? Okay, let's talk about Anaximander for a minute. Now, he's another guy that comes from Miletus. He's going to answer the same question that Thales is answering. Only he says, Thales, you know, you're a thinker, and I like that in a guy. But I got to tell you something. Your answer makes no sense. And Thales says, oh, yeah, Mr. Wise Guy. And I can just imagine these three guys sitting around arguing about this. One guy saying, no, everything's made out of water. And this guy, or hydre, or liquidity. And this guy says, no, everything's made out of. And he's going to tell you what he says everything's made out of. He says, you know what? Your theory has to be wrong, Thales, because water is something in the universe, is it not? And it's something in the world? Liquidity is something in the world, is it not? And he says, yeah. And he says, well, it doesn't make any sense. He says, you're telling me that In other words, if something in the world can be the basic stuff of which the whole world is made up of, then what is that one thing made up of? You can't use something in the world to say that everything's made up of it. Because that's also in the world. You're not being consistent. You know what I'm saying? You're dreaming here. It doesn't make any sense. And he says, so therefore, he comes up with a better idea. And he says all things are, whoa, did I tear that? No. Hello? Test? Okay. He says all things. He's got a Greek word. It looks like this in the Greek. Eperon, like this. And it's A-P-E-R-I-O-N-O-R. Is that right? Eperon?
E-I-R-O-N.
Eperon. And what is eperon, folks? He says eperon, this is a word that means the boundless. It means the, not infinite. Don't use the word infinite. You almost want to say that. But it means the thing which is without boundary. Here we go. See how we're skipping along here? He says eperon carries the idea of boundless without boundary, having no boundary, or unlimited, but not infinite. You can't use that word infinite or you're in big trouble. Indeterminate or indefinable, not having or defying definition. For example, the example that I use down here for indeterminate is, in other words, chalk is chalk. If I take a piece of chalk and I show it to you, I say this is chalk, okay? In order for, how do I want to put this? In order for this to be made up of a peron has to be, number one, it has to be neither chalk nor non-chalk.
These guys did a lot of drugs.
You get the idea, though? You see what he's getting at? He's saying that this can have this eperon can have nothing to do with chalk if it's the basic stuff of chalk. Do you follow what I'm saying?
How can they not believe in God? I can't understand.
I don't know. We'll talk about it later. They do believe in God.
Of course they have.
They believe in, but they believe in false gods.
But I mean, inside them, they must have believed in God himself because they're saying it without saying it. They just don't want to admit it, in other words. They're admitting it through their theory that infinity exists and that God exists.
Oh, no, they would never say infinity exists.
They would never say it, but you can see just by what they're saying.
Yeah.
It's like me saying, well, I don't really live in Swansea. I'm kind of on the edge. You know, I may be over in Rehoboth, but, you know, I'm not in Swansea. But you really are. They're admitting that they believe in God, but they just won't say it because that would make them look like idiots.
Okay.
Okay.
I don't know if I agree with you on that, but well let's continue anyway. The what is eperon? It has to be neither both chalk and non-chalk. It must be neither chalk nor non-chalk. Do you understand how difficult that is of a concept to grasp? Yeah.
What gives chalk its chalkiness?
What gives chalk its...
It's not the...
All right, let's talk chalk. What gives chalk its chalkiness? Let me try to explain maybe the way that he would try to explain it, okay? Here's what he says. In order for eperon, in order for something to be made up, in order for something to have a basic substance, okay, it has to be a combo... All right, it is not the substance of the thing that makes the thing the thing. It is the combination of eperon that makes the thing the thing.
But are you saying there's different kinds of eperon
then? No, different quantities.
So it's a different quantity of eperon mixed with what? A different quantity of
mixed eperon? With nothing. Mixed with eperon. Everything is eperon. The basic stuff of everything. The basic stuff of something as elusive as red. What is red? Red is made of eperon. What makes something red and what makes something green? Eperon. And the way that it's organized, and the way that it's... But see, look at what he says. Let's read the next part and then see if it clears some things up. It's a very difficult concept to understand, and you got to understand, these people are grappling with basically no scientific knowledge. They're grappling with a very difficult question, okay? Here's what he says. Eperon, what is it like? It contains every sort of shape and quality, but it has no specific characteristics at all. Okay? Now, that's almost impossible to understand. Watch this. He's getting at something like that. They would never use that. That doesn't get used until Aristotle. But they would never use that term. Now, it can become every shape or characteristic. Notice, every shape or characteristic, meaning red. You see what I mean? It can become every shape or characteristic. It can become every shape, smell, color, odor, taste, texture in the world. It is a neutral substance. Okay, ready? This is the way that Plato deals with that. He says, he uses the example, and I have it down here, of the perfume makers. People, in order to make perfume, Plato says, you have to start with a neutral base. A base that will not corrupt the ingredients that are put into the base. You get the idea? It's got to be a liquid substance, because we want our perfume to be liquid, right? It's got to be some kind of a liquid substance, but it has to be absolutely neutral, with which we can add the things that we want to add to make the fragrance we want to make. You see what I'm saying? Okay. The neutral substance is what Anaximander is getting at. It is a neutral substance. That's it. It's neutral. It is the neutral stuff with which everything is made.
Is a paron eternal?
Nothing is eternal. Nothing is eternal. There is no such thing as eternal. All of the gods had a birth. Well, you know, I don't think that they ever answered that question, and I don't think they could answer it satisfactorily. I mean, you know that the ancient world is riddled with all kinds of, unresolved questions that they never answered. And I mean, if we had a Greek that believed actually in Zeus today, it would probably be very easy to dissuade him as to his beliefs. I like this one thing. I was reading a book by this fellow right here, George Rue. Ancient Iraq, and it's a very, very good book. It gets into, you know, the things that happened in the Mesopotamia and things like that. But he talks about how he took a trip there, and he describes the morning. He says he woke up and he was down toward like where Sumer would be in the Shatt al-Arab waterway near the Persian Gulf. And he says when you wake up in the morning, he goes, everything is like a mist. It's like a foggy mist, and he goes, everything, it's impossible, it's absolutely impossible to distinguish between that which is sky and that which is sea, that which is air and that which is land. It's just, everything's like a misty, you know what I mean? And you can see that there are things there, but you cannot distinguish anything there until some of the mist clears away with the more complete rising of the sun. And that, when I read that, I thought of Eperon. I think that that's a good idea of what he might be getting at. That kind of cloudy thing, okay? All right, now I don't want to spend too much time on him. I just want to say one more thing about him. He had a very unique cosmology. Excuse me. Okay, he had a very unique cosmology. And I'm going to show you the beautiful picture that I drew of his cosmology. You have it in your handout. Isn't that great? I did that. Believe it or not, I basically didn't have any help for that at all. It was that was my own. I was going to ask for some help with it, and I said, "No, I can do this." Well, this is his cosmology. Now, I want you to think about something. He's looking up, and he's trying to look at the world and figure out what is it like. What is the world like with the planets and all of this? And what he comes up with is that. Now, watch this. He sees stars in the sky. Okay, he sees stars in the sky. He sees the world, the universe, as swirling, as being in like a swirl like this. And because of the motion, he says that inside all of the cold stuff stays here inside, and toward the outer edge, the hot stuff stays. And he considers that fire and air. Now he sees the Earth as being in this thing, and on the outside, he's looking at this from the center, and you know what he sees? He sees fire. Now this is very, very. I want you to think about this. I find this fascinating. He's going to look at the stars, and he's going to say that the stars are not balls of fire in the sky. He's going to say that here there is a blanket of air all around here, okay? A thick blanket of air all around the outer edge of the universe. And outside of that blanket of air is fire. Fire, all this here is fire. Obviously, just by looking at it, you can tell the all-consuming fire of the masterful diagram I did. Now the fire, so when he sees the stars, you know what he sees? He's not seeing stars in the sky. He's seeing tiny dots in the blanket of air. And he goes, when I see that little tiny dot, what I'm seeing is the fire that's behind the blanket of air that is normally unseen. That's pretty brilliant. It sounds ridiculous to us today, knowing what we know about astronomy, but you figure a man standing there looking up and he goes, that's incredible. All those little pinpoints of light. They must be little imperfections in the blanket of air. And it fits perfectly into his view. Okay. That's all we're going to talk about with him. And we're going to come back. We're going to spend only a minute on these guys here. Bing, bing, bing. Only a minute talking about these guys. I'll talk about Anaximenes a little bit. He's not all that interesting. He's got a couple of really good points. But he just believes that there's something else that the universe is made out of. And he's got another thing we're going to talk about. These guys are important in that they contrast each other, and that's all that I'm going to bring up with them, so that I can set something up for the sophists later on. And Pythagoras, we're going to spend a little bit of time with. Okay, all right. Why don't we take a? Let's take a 10-minute break. Why don't we come back at 25 of? Okay, try to be prompt because I want to try to cover some of this stuff tonight and knock it out. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get rolling again. Okay, we just want to say a couple words about Anaximenes, and he's probably the least interesting of these three guys on the top here. He does have something that is very intriguing, though, that we are going to look at quickly. He flourishes about 535 BC, slightly younger than Anaximander. Like Thales and Anaximander, he is also from Miletus. In a way, he's the least interesting of the three because he doesn't happen to be the first of anything. He doesn't really come up with anything new. But he seems to be going backwards from Anaximander's Boundless and back to Thales. Now, what he says is that all things are air. A-E-R. Looks like this. In the Greek, A-E-R in the English. He says that all things are made out of air. Now we've gone with this guy right back to the Sumerians. We've gone right back to Lil. He says air itself is the basic stuff of the universe, and that everything is begotten from it. Okay. The thing that intrigues me about him, though, and that's basically all that you need to know as far as that's concerned. But he comes up with a very creative way of explaining how things happen in physics. And he says that everything is the result of either compression or rarefaction, meaning the word air in the Greek means breath. What happens when you breathe? What happens to your lungs? And when you breathe out, right? And they become smaller. He believes that the world, the entire universe, is breathing in this way, and that everything is a result of rarefaction and compression. And here's what he says, okay? It's a very cool theory, because watch this. What is gas? That which is not very, very densely compressed. What is a solid? Something which is very densely compressed. You see what I mean? He says that the difference between this and a rock and water and gas are merely the way that air is compressed. That's what he comes up with. That's pretty unusual, pretty wild. Yes?
And isn't it also a fact that in part of the creation of the world, it's the Big Bang Theory, everything was like compressed together all at once and blew apart? And
absolutely.
Now it's on a constantly expanding level?
Well, you mean growing that
growing apart,
right? That's open to a lot of skepticism as far as the continuous expanse of the universe. But one day I remember listening to a man, I'll never forget it because I was eating macaroni and cheese, which is like a deplorable meal that for anybody to eat. But I know why it's 25 cents per metric ton for this stuff. But it's like when you think about it, they take macaroni, they put it in a box, okay, in a box with a little foil aluminum pouch made out of some kind of. It's not cheese, but it's not non-cheese. It's a Éperon. It's Éperon cheese, and they put it inside the box, and then they seal up the box, and then it goes from the craft manufacturer all the way to distributors in trucks. It gets put on the shelf, and people have to ticket it and put it on the shelf, and they can sell them five for a dollar. Isn't that like unbelievable? How can they do that? Five for a dollar. It tells you what's in it. It is absolutely the worst food that, you know, humans were not meant to eat that stuff. But, okay, so listen to this.
You don't get Kraft at that price. You get the cheaper ones.
Oh, you get the Almax, okay.
You get three for a dollar for the Kraft.
Oh, all right, okay. All right. So here's the idea, though. What does that have to do with anything? What are we talking about? Oh, expanding. Well, I'm sitting there eating my Kraft macaroni and cheese because we had a little extra money in the paycheck that week. And I said, honey, no, let's live on the edge. Put those Almax back. Let's take the Kraft. And sure, throw in a couple of the Alphabet ones. We got money. I'm sitting there and I'm watching the McNeil Lahr News Hour on Channel 2, which is probably the only news you can even come close to trusting on television. That's one thing that PBS does right. And they remind you of it about 18 times a year. When they play all those shows that you want to see only when they're trying to raise money. And then the rest of the year it's like, the real life of the octopus, today on Nature. Like, ooh. This is what I donated for. But anyway, to make a very long story short, I'm sitting down and I'm watching the McNeil Lahr News Hour, and they come up with this new theory now, and they have this scientist, and I'll never forget the way this guy was so stuck up. He was like, everybody else was like here, and he's like here, you know. McNeil says, could you explain for the common people what happens, what Big Bang is all about, how can you explain it for the common man? He goes, okay, let me try to, you know, bring it down for you. And I hate being condescended to. I just think that's so ridiculous. Anybody on television condescending to someone who's not on television doesn't make sense. You know, it's like, well, anyway, listen, I'm not going to get into that. But here's the idea. He says, at one time, the entire universe was compressed into a dot smaller than a dot on your television set. Now, I remember choking on my macaroni as I was watching this, because that made so little sense to me. Can you imagine the universe now, which is, listen, we live in a solar system which is absolutely gigantic. As a matter of fact, I think I've told you a little bit about Betelgeuse, the planet Betelgeuse. Okay, if you shrunk the entire solar system down, if you shrunk the whole solar system down so that the sun was the size of the head of a pin. You know these pins that women use to hem your pant legs there? Those one with the little ball at the end, okay? If you put it all down and the sun is the size of the head of a pin, okay? Then you could fit the entire solar system in an average size living room. In this model, this scale model, the entire solar system would fit in an average size living room, okay? However, if you were going to walk, the whole universe now shrunk down to this scale. If you were going to walk to the next nearest star, you would have to walk at this scale 27 miles away from your living room to get to the next nearest star. Okay? To give you just a sense of how huge, and that's still within our galaxy, or galaxy, however you want to say it. We have a solar system, which is one of many solar systems, in the galaxy known as the Milky Way. Right? And the galaxy that we live in is one of billions of galaxies in the universe. And we can't even come close to numbering them. So there are billions of galaxies, of which there are millions of solar systems in our galaxy alone. We're on the outer edge. Our solar system is on the outer edge of the Milky Way. And that's why we can see it so clear, the whole Milky Way sometimes in the sky. We're on the outer edge. And it's like every star that we see in the sky is a part of our galaxy. every star that we see in the sky, in our, from our sky, is the is in our galaxy. And there are billions of galaxies. And each one has millions of solar systems. There are millions of solar systems in the Milky Way. So it's absolutely ridiculous to even try to put God in a box. God said, hey, you know why? You know why we can't do it? Because God, one day, he took Abraham out and he said, Abraham, see that? When you can number those stars, I'll stop loving you. Jeremiah chapter 30, I think. He says, when God says, when you can look up and you can number those stars, I'll stop loving you, Israel. And when the sun stops coming up and when the sun stops going down, I'll stop loving you, Israel. And the sun came up today and it's going down. And okay? All right. I don't know how we got onto all that, but back to this. So this
you
whole
forgot,
thing about...
Gene, you forgot something.
What?
How was that food you eat? Was it good or bad?
Oh, well, it was...
I'm wondering.
Were you really eating it?
I was really eating it. I played with it for a while, then I figured, hey, I got to eat it. Or else my wife had hit me with that wooden spoon she had. Ah, okay, yeah, it's good, yeah. Can you throw a couple Spam chunks in here? The mystery meat, the Aperon meat of the universe. The undefinable, what is Spam? Nobody knows. Anything that they have to pack in that much preservative jelly cannot be good for you, folks. Why don't you just come to the back and admit it? Preservative fat jelly, whatever, okay? It tastes as good, all right. Now, so according to his theory, if the molecules are compressed tightly enough, we end up with a solid. Pressed more loosely, a liquid will result. Even looser, we get a gas. Sounds pretty good to me. I like it. The basic stuff of the universe is air. We then have, once again, as with the Sumerians, Babylonians, Hittites, Assyrians, and Thales, the notion of a world where everything is alive, but somehow now a mechanical aspect is added to it, and that's the breathing. There's a breathing. There's constant compression and rarefaction. And this is the guy from The Sleepwalkers that I was telling you about, that very good book, and there's a quote I have from him. The system of Anaximenes, who was an associate of Anaximander, is less inspired, but he seems to have been the originator of the important idea that the stars are attached like nails to a transparent sphere of crystalline material which turns around the earth like a hat around the head. Now listen, this sounds crazy, but look at this. This theory is going to live for a long time, all through the Middle Ages. Let me grab a... I have about 400 erasers and I can never find one. He says, remember, even in the Middle Ages now, this is the idea that they have of the earth. I'm going to draw it small. Here's the earth, okay? And there is a glass ball. This is what Aristotle says, okay? There's a glass globe around that, like a Christmas ball, okay? See this? This is going to go right into the Middle Ages, folks. What happens is, here's Earth, and there are planets here, okay? What's holding the planets in their orbit? Why aren't they coming crashing? Aristotle says, how come this thing, if Earth is the heaviest body, he believed Earth was the heaviest body in existence, why do not these spheres come crashing to the Earth? And his answer was, there are glass balls. And in between the glass balls, the planets move on their in their rotation, and air is propelling them, or he calls it ether, A-E-T-H-E-R, he called it ether, is propelling them, okay? And even Aristotle said, yeah, but what's making the planets move? He says, it has to be moved by the unmoved mover, which is God. He had to come to the point where Aristotle had to say, there's an unmoved, or a prime mover, or something had to get this thing moving and sustain it. Now watch this, okay? One day, there's a guy by the name of Tycho Brahe. Ever hear of him before, Tycho?
Oh, Tycho, yeah.
Tycho, T-Y-C-H-O-B-B-R-A-H-E, Brahe, like that. Tycho Brahe is a very famous astronomer. One day he's looking up, he used to hang out with Johannes Kepler, who was a real trip. I wish we could get into all that, but we can't. Johannes Kepler's a real trip because he's got to take time out from his studies to go and defend his mother, who's up on witchcraft charges. And he finally, all of his brothers and sisters says, let the old lady burn, let her go, she's no good. And he says, no, he goes, takes time, and he successfully defends her. But he dies, and Brahe rips off all of his stuff. He rips off everything, all of his... he runs, as soon as he finds out he dies, because he knows the important records that Kepler's been keeping. Kepler is a nut, though. And we'll see... well, we'll see it here in a minute. Kepler's a nut because he's going to take some of the Pythagoreans' things, and these guys are out to lunch. And he's going to say, you know what? These guys say that the planets make music when they go around the solar system. I'm going to show you why, okay? They say the planets make music when they go around the solar system, right? Johannes Kepler figures out the notes. He figures, Jupiter. I ought to give you a copy of that. There's Jupiter. Okay, you want to hear Mars? I figured it out mathematically. Yes, 16th note, folks. 16th note followed by a whole note. Ding, ding, ding. Ding, ding, ding. And that's the... these guys are out of their minds. What?
Close Encounters.
Have no idea what you mean. Oh, all right, okay.
They brought the music home.
Okay. Here's the idea. Here's the idea, though. Earth is here, and Aristotle has these glass balls. Does everybody get the picture? Tycho Brahe, though, is looking through one of these telescopes one day, and he sees something he cannot understand. You know what he sees?